My name is Debbie Kumail Bell. Thank you for being here, yes. I've been working with the ACLU for 11 years now as their artist ambassador for racial justice. So anytime racism is better, you're welcome. Anytime racism is bad, I did my best. So yes, and I'm happy to be here. You may know me from my New York Times bestselling book, Do the Work, or my docuseries, We Need to Talk About Cosby, or as most people know me, the guy in the ACLU commercials on cable news. So my first guest is the executive director of the ACLU of Michigan, who has fought to protect the rights of Michiganders for nearly two decades. Please get up for Lauren Hojali.
You did it.
So how did I do?
That was awesome. Talking?
Pretty good.
Yasser. That was amazing, right?
Oh, thank you. I'll get to your intro in a second. Now. But talk about, we had this whole conversation about your last name and how I heard you tell people to pronounce it and then how he really pronounced it. I was like, I got to try to go with
you. Yeah, I am very impressed. So somebody asked me how to pronounce it. I said, we say Kogali. There's an Arabic pronunciation. I won't require you to say it. And Kumail said, I'm going to try it. What do you say? I said, you got to get the kh.
No, I know.
Hojali.
I know I didn't go full kh, but I'm working on it.
You were half kh.
My steps. My next guest is a Hamtramck-based filmmaker and producer whose work focuses on democracy and human rights. Some of his films include Hamtramck USA, Three Chaplains, and Rouge. Please give it up for Razi Jaffer, everybody. How did I do, Razi? Razi Jaffery, did I do that all right?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with you, Razi, because since I'm the host of the podcast, they gave me all these questions, but whatever.
A big pile.
Yeah. How did me and you meet initially? I want to hear that
story. It's a great story.
Yeah.
So we met, it must have been in the fall of 2016.
Yes.
We met in Hamtramck at an Islamophobia rally. I was against the Islamophobia.
Yes. So. And of course I was. It's also against.
So you were producing and hosting the show United Shades of America, and we had a conversation that was taped and that ended up making it into the show, and that was the start of a beautiful friendship. And Then we didn't see each other for the next 8 years.
No, because we left on like a bad note.
Yeah, we had a bit of a tiff.
And
yeah,
I was like, 8 years from now, it'll be okay. None of that happened. But it was just the nature of the way things work. Like, I remember you were speaking at the anti-Islamophobic rally.
Gotta be clear.
It was days after there'd been an election, and a guy named President Trump had won, and Hamtramck in Dearborn understandably had feelings about it. And I was just there to get B-roll, but you spoke and I was like, I want to talk to that guy, which they didn't always let me do on that show in the early days. But I was like, I really want to talk to him. So we talked on camera and I was like, this guy's gonna have a big future. And now you're a filmmaker. So I was right. So I'm happy to have you here.
Great to be here.
Worked out tonight. So let's start with an easy question. Start with you, Lauren. Best restaurant in Detroit, go.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of good restaurants in Detroit, but my go-to is Ima on Michigan, Ima Itzakaya, which is owned by Mike Ransom, who's amazing. So huge shout out to Mike and the good ramen at Ima.
Okay. All right. Razi?
Oof, this is so hard. And I live in Hamtramck, so I'm going to go with a place that's not in Hamtramck, but very close. Baobab Fair, owned by Mamba Hamisi, award-winning chef, won the last season of Chopped. It's amazing. Oh. Highly recommend. So
that was my second recommendation to come out.
You did mention that. So that's, yeah. So you did. So you mentioned both those places. You know, right now, as you just said, Lauren, we're 47 days away from an election. That means that takes up a lot of space, a lot of air in the public conversation. Michigan, specifically because of the state of the world, is taking up a lot of space in the conversation. This audience of people here maybe are wired into the issues, but people who are listening to this who are not from here, what do you think they need to know about Michigan? What do you think we get wrong, those of us who are not from here? What do you think we need to know about Michigan? I'll start with you. Again, Lauren, I'll start with you.
Yep.
I think one thing that is really important to recognize about Michigan is that it is an incredibly diverse state. And I think people sometimes underappreciate the diverse state. And like any state, communities grow in pockets. But even within those communities, people are not monoliths. And I think one thing that happens, especially as we near elections, is we start this sort of transactional communication with people, sound bites, things like that. And look, the reality is they are necessary. We have messages that we have to make sure people understand how to vote. But the real, they can be incredibly harmful when they start to target communities in a way that turns into misinformation or undermines the diversity that exists in communities. Because the reality is, although we do a ton of work leading into elections, the real work around building an inclusive, sustainable democracy happens in those years in between. And it's that little de-democracy that exists at people's kitchen tables and the places that they go to worship and, in the community parks and the places people more naturally and organically gather and actually get to know each other and step into each other's shoes. And so I think that's something that feels particularly important heading into this election season.
Nice. Rozzy?
Yeah, I think Michigan is very diverse. I agree. There's so many different communities here. I'm connected to a lot of those communities as well as an Asian American, as a Muslim, as an immigrant. I think one of the communities that's been getting a lot of attention in this 2024 election season is the Arab and the Muslim community in Michigan.
Yeah, and I think that, I know this because when I came here with United Shades, like I was unaware, one, of the size of the Arab and Muslim population here. To the connection to the auto industry.
Yeah.
And then to find out about like all the political and activist community building that was done, there's the 1973 UAW strike. I just think there's a much, this happens every place around the country, I find, but there's a deep history of activism and resistance and community coming together here that I think people outside of here don't really know about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts about the history of community, of the history of activism here?
Yeah, I mean, particularly in terms of the Arab and Muslim community, there's been interconnectedness with other movements around labor, around civil rights, and that often manifests itself in activism, like grassroots activism, organizing. And I think, this community is a community that, politicians really should be paying attention to. And so you have 250,000 roughly eligible Muslim voters in the state of Michigan.
Yeah. Lauren, how does the ACLU engage with these communities? Because I feel like in America, if you're an Arab or Muslim America, you're already you're born into a political body. You're like, you're already sort of an activist, whether you sort of choose to be or not. So how does the ACLU engage with the Arab and Muslim community here?
So I think there's a couple really important things to just note, and maybe even thinking a little bit about the question that you just asked, Rozzy. I think the big important movements that we've seen over the last several years in Michigan, they're all intersectional and they all originate from the people. And so I think about the organizing that happened around the Flint water crisis, right? That was a humanitarian issue that didn't just impact the people in Flint, but it impacted any community who was at risk having unsafe water because the state made a decision that allowed children to be poisoned, right? And I think about the last several years in Michigan and the advancements that we've made in voting rights and the advancements that have happened in reproductive rights, those all grew out of the people. And it's, and I think it's really important to think about each of those movements, the Arab and Muslim communities were incredibly important partners in making sure that in their communities that they understood the impact of reproductive rights and how basic healthcare would be impacted. And so one of the things I will just share is we approached this election season, which obviously starts months and months and months ago. I mean, one of the things we knew because of everything that Rozzy just said is people in this state, not just Arab and Muslim voters, but especially young voters, are feeling incredibly disaffected. They did not see their values reflected in the administration as it was operating, were showing up for people, because at the end of the day, our job is to make sure that people understand the power in their vote and making sure we're meeting them where they are, right? And so understanding that people, one of the things that we understood pretty quickly is even though people were being disaffected, as soon as they understood that there were races on their ballots that would impact issues that they really deeply cared about, their ears sort of perked up. And they were willing to show up to vote once they saw their power at the ballot box.
There's so much being made. I mean, I live in California, which is not a battleground state. I don't know when the last time it was a battleground state, but we sort of like, I feel like, and I want to be clear, voting is super important. And I encourage people in California, like we have to think about the local elections and the statewide elections. And while you're in there, pick a president. It's sort of a fun thing to do. You know what I mean? Like, because it's just a different state because of the Electoral College. If it was a popular vote thing, it would be different. But on the you two being from here, what is it like to be in a battleground state? If you could snap your fingers and not make it a battleground state, would you do that?
You know, democracy is so messy. You know, it's an imperfect system. And so what makes the system so beautiful is that you take these like spectrum of ideas and they compete, you know, they campaign for your votes, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think if it wasn't for that and we didn't have a choice and we lived in a state that was a bit more clear cut, I guess it wouldn't be as interesting, you know? So I don't know. There's a part of me that's like, yeah, I think particularly in a time like this, I wish especially around certain human rights issues that we could coalesce and have a unified, you know, voting base and informed voting base around it. But naturally we're human beings and we live in a diverse, you know, community in a diverse state. We're going to have differing opinions. So that only behooves us to move to advocate for the issues that we care about even more. But Michigan just keeps becoming more and more purple. And, you know, you have strong gun rights movements and you have a strong labor movement. And there's so many issues that are like that in Michigan that are like, when you take topic by topic, you have opinions and views that are at the end of the spectrum. And so they just have to fight themselves out. Hopefully it's all, you know, peaceful. So. Yeah, no.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Lauren, what do you think about that? The idea of like, does being a battleground state help this state in some way, or does it distract in some way?
I mean, not being a battleground state would like be better for my blood pressure. But I mean, I think these last several years, as we've become more and more purple, the sort of battleground nature of our state has actually served as a catalyst for people to make the change that they want to see, for communities to get activated, for people to be like, huh, library boards seem really important all of a sudden, mm-hmm. right? Like, I don't think that I've seen sort of the interest and in civic level of civic engagement mm-hmm. Around local races or court races as I do right now, because I think the way that we've seen the Supreme Court shift and really start to, they are no longer an ally or even a dependable rational place to sort of have discussions about what civil liberties and civil rights should look like, right? That has really shifted to our states. And that means it shifted to the voters in this state to say, wait a second, I actually don't want my kid to have less rights than I did. And mm-hmm. so the catalyst of that, I actually think is important. Now, what I think is really going to be important moving forward is we've sort of made these significant advancements through voters showing up and saying this is what is important to us. But there's a really long game here and sort of pivoting to make sure that we're doing the work in communities as an organization, as families, as communities, to make sure that we continue to understand the impact of what we've done over the last 7 years in Michigan is going to be really important.
If I can just add a little bit real quick. I mean,
no, you cannot.
We're also seeing like, particularly in the last like 8 to 12 years, the importance of Michigan rising. You know, Donald Trump starts and ends his campaigns in Michigan. We had a very, very active and engaged 2022 state election, which was, you know, big news in 2022 nationally. Our primary was moved up earlier. And so that's all a result of both voter engagement and a more informed voter base, but also the importance of Michigan on a national stage as well.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about Detroit as being this area of Michigan being heavily Arab and Muslim, but it's also Detroit is one of America's historically Black cities.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that sometimes the Black community feels like we're sort of like shunted to the side when other communities' issues are sort of put forward. How do you navigate that in a city like Detroit, which has a very proud Black history, a very proud civil rights Black history, when there's sort of these issues, when other issues come to the, go to the headlines? How do you coalition build?
I think as Lauren mentioned, I mean, there's a great intersectional approach to so much activism in Detroit. And so, you know, when you're discussing issues like the Flint water crisis, the Muslim community really engaged in this issue, you know, back in 2014, 2015, 2016. And now with Gaza, you have Black pastors, you have the Black Lives Matters movement that's been very supportive. You know, one of the other things that we're seeing is a really deep interfaith movement in Michigan and many other places. You know, covering the ceasefire movement right now for one of my projects, I go to a lot of protests. At these protests, what 20, 25, 30 years ago used to be a majority Palestinian Arab Muslim contingency has now grown into what you see as a minority. And you have a majority of folks that are attending these protests and supporting the Palestinian cause who aren't Arab, who aren't Muslim. So you see this real intersectional rise in, you know, this particular issue that's interfaith. You see, you know, a sizable percentage of Jewish activism as well that's engaged with this. And on the other side, you know, in, you know, 2017, 2020, at different peaks in the Black Lives Matter movement, particularly here in Michigan, you saw droves of members of the Muslim community also show up for those movements. And I think this is a very good thing as communities work together to support each other's causes and issues because they're interconnected and they affect us all.
Yeah. Lauren, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think just putting my ACLU hat on for a moment, I think it's really...
Oh, you've had it off the whole time?
I haven't had it off. But I mean, like, I think there's something really... I think there's a real call to action for advocacy organizations in that question, right? Which is, we never successfully do movement work alone, right? No organization can because of the intersectional nature of that. And so, like... you know, it just calls up for me, like when we're doing work around voting rights, one of our partners here, Detroit Disability Power, did this incredible audit of polling places across Michigan. And it turns out, although we had made this huge expansion of voting rights in Michigan, we really left the disability community out of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And so, right, it was an opportunity to reset and broaden the way that all of the organizations were working in coalition to make sure that we weren't sort of, that we were standing in other people's shoes, so to say, to make sure we were actually meeting the needs of our community as a whole, not just certain sections of a community.
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing up the disability community. I always have to bring up my friend Alice Wong, who's a disability advocate, started the hashtag CryptoVote on Twitter years ago. And she was on an episode of United Shades, and she talked about the idea that like people don't understand that like a world that is more accessible for people with disabilities is actually a world that's more accessible for all of us. And so we often shunt the disability community off to the side, not realizing that like there's curb cuts in the sidewalk because of the disability community. And every parent who's ever pushed a stroller is thank God for those curb cuts.
Mm.
So I think it is important to think about like, when we are coalition building, that those things, that often the things that you're helping one group accomplish can help you too. And, you know, not that you have to be selfish about it, but I think people often think about like sort of us versus them, and that's not how it has to be. Yeah, yeah. So, Razi, I know you're working on a project right now that features Arab and Muslim folks, which means that you're talking. I would imagine there's this thing that happens when you're out in the work doing the work with Arab Muslim folks and you go home and watch TV that there's a disconnect in representation. What do you think about that? The idea, when you look at TV and the media, how do you think Arab Muslims are being represented currently when you turn on the TV versus the work you're doing every day?
You know, year after year, it's a great question. And year after year, my
thank you.
My
That's
answer.
Two great questions, everybody. Two. That's
we should
two.
Quit. We should just end the podcast.
Yeah, no, it's coming up. It's coming up. I'm wrapping it up.
But, you know, year after year, my answer to that question changes because the circumstances change, the situation changes. And so while at the same time, we see better representation, you know, with shows like Rami and Mo, you see more and more Muslim characters on mainstream, you know, television shows and streamer shows. I think that's a really good thing. Obviously, the more representation, the more diversity we have, the better it is. But look, part of the reason why I, you know, left my career as an engineer to become a storyteller and filmmaker to represent my community is because there was like a binary that was representing our community as either victims of terrorism or perpetrators of terrorism. And so I wanted to show a more nuanced take because it just didn't exist. Most of the stories about Muslims in America and around the world were being told by non-Muslim directors, producers, filmmakers, and the results actually hurt our community. And so that's what's driving so much of my work. And I don't think that we are in a place that you know, is equitable right now. I think we have a small group of Muslim and Arab filmmakers who are working in the industry, who are making amazing work. Some have been nominated and won major awards and things like that. But I think we still need to see so much more improvement. I think that obviously has an impact on the collective consciousness of how we perceive certain communities. And so one of the reasons why Americans believe what they believe about Muslims, about Arabs, is because of what they see on television and in the news. And so the way that we're portrayed really matters, but who's doing the portraying? So it's complicated. I think things are getting better. I hope more people go into this field and journalism and creative writing to tell those critical stories about the Muslim American community, because it's only going to create a more equitable and safer environment for all of us.
As people ask me this sort of question all the time, do you consider your work to be activism or advocacy, or is it just I'm a filmmaker telling stories?
It's definitely activism and advocacy, and I would also add that it's decolonizing work also. That's a big framework.
Well, you raised my life.
I'll take your activism and I'll raise you.
To decolonize.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're so framed by a racial lens as minorities. I mean, this is not a lens that we wanted, but, you know, as minorities, as BIPOC individuals and indigenous communities, you know, a racial lens is imposed on us. And a colonial lens is imposed on us. And so there's so much deconstruction work that we have to do as artists and writers and thinkers to create our own language and frameworks for how we represent our communities. The history of Orientalism, for instance, you know, I don't want to go into it too much, but, you know, Edward Said writes about this so people can look him up. But, you know, this post-colonial, area of studies in academia is founded on decolonizing work in academia. And so, you know, I see a lot of my work in that realm, but so much of that work has to be done internally for myself first. So that way I can educate audiences on, you know, how these communities should be perceived in a more sensitive and accurate and nuanced way. So
nice. Lauren, my last question for you, and then I have one question for both of you. You're leading the ACLU of Michigan's Get Out the Vote effort.
Yeah.
What have you learned? What have you learned out there in the field about voters or about potential voters or voters who aren't registered? What has that taught you being out there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one thing that is really important that we've learned is the people really want to know that their vote counts for something, that when they show up and vote, that it is actually making a difference, that they're shaping their community, that they're shaping their nation. And so helping people understand that, as you mentioned, Rezi, in 2022, the voter turnout around the ballot initiatives to establish, to create a constitutional amendment to protect reproductive freedom and to broaden our voting rights in Michigan, there were people who stood in line for hours upon hours upon hours to cast their votes, to make their voices heard. Mm-hmm. And what people don't understand, courts are mysterious, right? We don't understand what they do, but it is those courts now in the state that are going to shape what those constitutional amendments mean. What do those rights mean? When the legislature transitioned and passed, for the first time in 30 years, protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Our state Supreme Court is going to make those decisions.
Yeah. Thank you for that. My last question to both of you is, Give these people some homework. Give people who are listening some homework. What would you like them to engage with? What would you like them to do? What would you like them to read? What would you like to watch? Roz, I know you're working on a project that you might have a short film come out before the election. Start with you, Roz. Give the people some homework.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's so many things. I think the sort of broad thing is like educate yourself on the issues, particularly right now. I think, you know, it's really important to listen to the perspective of the Arab and Muslim community, because it's an issue that is affecting hundreds and thousands of people in the state of Michigan, but it's also affecting many people across the country. You have, you know, lobbying dollars, you have, attacks on free speech. You have people losing their jobs, you know, over this issue. And I think, honestly, probably one of the number one issues where free speech is compromised is around Palestinian activism. And so I would really encourage people to educate yourselves on this particular issue and understand where movements like the Uncommitted Movement are coming from. Because, look, they're not saying we're done with democracy. They're not saying we're not going to vote. In fact, they're saying, you know, we want to use the democratic system to advance an issue that we really care about a lot. It's an important issue that people should educate themselves on, and check out Ta-Nehisi's article on Uncommitted. So
nice. Thank you for that. Lauren, give these people some homework.
So a couple things. I think be curious and be committed. Be critical. Interestingly enough, Razi, I think you were just... One of the things, there was an article in the New York Times last weekend about how Muslim and Arab voters in Michigan specifically are being targeted by ads that are highlighting the fact that Doug Emhoff is Jewish as a way to inflame, right? And interestingly enough, my daughter, who is not of voting age, received one of those ads and thought to herself, something about this doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
And brought it up to me. And we started talking about it. But like, be curious and be critical. Where is your information coming from? And how do you stand in other folks' shoes? Yeah. And then, you know, the other thing is absolutely do the work to know what is on your ballot. And when I say what is on your ballot in Michigan, I mean up and down your ballot. I know that in the media and in our everyday lives, everybody is talking about the presidential race. That's a critically important race. If we want a democracy to hold accountable, we have to have a democracy.
That tracks.
Yeah, but the state Supreme Court race in Michigan is critical. The district court judges races, the school board races, the library board races, city council races, the state house race. Really take the time to understand who is running in those races, whether they reflect your values, and then make sure that you get out and make a plan to vote. The really incredible thing about the work that's been done in Michigan by the ACLU and by many partners across the state in the last 7 years is that there are so many ways to vote now. You can vote by absentee ballot. You can take advantage of 9 days of early voting. You can show up on election day and vote. So make sure that you don't just commit to voting, but make a plan for how you're going to vote and make sure you know what's on that ballot.
Thank you, you two. Please get up for Lauren and Rosie, everybody. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of At Liberty. We hope you enjoyed these conversations. To learn more about the ACLU's fight for voting rights this election season and how you can join, look in the episode description. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I've been W. Kamau Bell, and remember, friends don't let friends not vote. Good night, everybody.